Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
It's hard to describe. You know, it's not necessarily valued in the society, but just having an older man, a powerful man at your shoulder is, I think, really important for men as their souls are developing.
The Medicine Path podcast is an ongoing exploration into the intersections of spirituality, depth psychology, and psychedelics. The Medicine Path is a wholly independent and listener-supported project, so please consider becoming a supporter at patreon.com/medicinepath or by subscribing and leaving a review on iTunes. You can find out more information at medicinepathpodcast.com. Now, here's your host, Brian James.
Welcome to the Medicine Path Podcast. I'm your host, Brian James. On this episode, I speak with two OGs of the mythopoetic men's movement, Walton Stanley and Timothy Young. Walton and Tim currently organize the Minnesota Men's Conference and were there way back in 1984 when it was founded by poet Robert Bly. In our conversation, they share some great stories about the early days and talk about how men's work has contributed to their lives and local communities. They also offer their perspective on how men's work has evolved over the years and where they see it going in the future. And finally, they address some of the criticisms against the early men's movement as being a reaction against feminism. Over the years, I've received so much inspiration and encouragement from listening to the Minnesota Men's Conference archival recordings featuring wise elders like Robert Bly, Michael Mead, James Hillman, Robert Moore, and Martin Prechtel. So I'm deeply grateful to Walton and Tim for keeping the home fire burning over there in the Northeast and for generously sharing the collective wisdom from decades of men's conferences for free. So I highly recommend subscribing to the Minnesota Men's Conference YouTube channel. And if you're interested in attending the conference in person, please visit minnesotamensconference.com. Now please sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Walton Stanley and Timothy Young on the Medicine Path.
Okay, well, I'm here with Tim Young and Walton Stanley, and I just first want to welcome you guys to the podcast. It's the first time I've had two people on at the same time.
Well, hello, Brian.
Yeah, hey, Brian. We'll try not to make a mess of it here.
Yeah, I'll do my best too. I think it might be helpful if you guys just started by introducing yourselves and talking a little bit about, what you do, and that'll help people just listening identify your voices too. So if you could say your name and just a little bit about yourself, that'd be great.
Sure. I'll start. I'm Walton Stanley. So I live in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and have been involved with the Minnesota Men's Conferences since the first one in 1984, where I met Tim Young and a number of other guys. Now I help to produce and lead the men's conferences and carry stories into the conferences.
Great. Hey, Tim.
And I'm Tim Young. Oh, I'm Tim Young. Likewise, I met Walton at the very first men's conference in 1984, Northern Minnesota. I'm a poet with my fifth book coming out this fall. I've been involved with the conference in many different positions, organized a few. I even washed dishes for a few years, you know. But it's not only the men's conference, the Minnesota Men's Conference, that we've been involved in. Walton and I have also been involved in the local men's work for ever since the beginning. We had a men's council for a number of years, and we were in a small men's group for, or we still are in a small men's group after 38, 39 years. So we've had a lot of experience in this area.
Yeah, and I want to thank our friend Asher in Australia, who runs a platform called The Fifth Direction, inspired by Robert Bly's work. And he works with you guys as kind of elders from afar, and he's the one who put us together. So just a shout out to Asher in Australia.
Yeah, exactly. Asher has attended some of our conferences virtually, along with some of the other guys from Australia. So it's been lovely getting to know them, even if it's through the technological medium.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've been very interested in the whole history of the men's movement, and I'm a big fan and student of Robert Bly's work and some of the other people that came out of that whole scene. And I know other people are too. Every time I do, like when Robert Bly died last year, I had a few people on who knew him pretty well to talk about him. And I got an outpouring of messages from people who had been touched by his work directly over the years or through the recordings that you guys at the Minnesota Men's Conference have been putting out steadfastly for years. So it's obvious that there's like a lot of love and respect for this guy. And I love to hear the stories of the old days, how it all went down, to kind of like help bring it to life for me and for others to understand what it was all about and what was going on beyond the way maybe the media covered it at the time or even now looking back. Mm-hmm. So I would love to start out, if you guys could talk about what it was like at the beginning there. Like, how did you find out about it initially? Maybe talk about what that first conference or two was actually like.
I'd
like to start, Walton, because I met Robert Bly a couple of years before the first men's conference. I was studying poetry in graduate school at the University of Minnesota. And Robert came to spend a couple seminars with us. And after one seminar, he says, would you come with me? I have to do a poetry reading at another college, and I'd just love to have somebody around because these were quite young college students, whereas I was at that time 30 years old. And I followed Robert, and he gave this incredible reading. And at the time, he was doing poetry with a dulcimer, accompanying himself with a dulcimer. And for years at men's conferences, he would accompany his poetry with a bouzouki. But at that poetry reading, when he finished the poems, he brought the dulcimer over and set it on my lap. And it's at that time I says, oh, I have to know more about this man. I love what he is doing. And a year later, Walton and I, although we didn't meet, it was February of 84, Robert Bly did an evening where he told the story of Iron John. And the church basement where we were at was filled with men. And I was astonished. I had never heard fairy tales used in that way. And I'd been studying literature my whole adult life. So I got hooked. Alton, you were at that evening, right?
Yep. Yeah, I was. In fact, so I was in I kind of fell into a small men's group because my wife was in a women's group. And so she and a number of women were getting together for breakfasts on, you know, Sundays periodically. And a bunch of guys who were partners of those women said, well, you know, we can have breakfast too. So we started meeting. And eventually, you know, we kind of continued meeting and expanded the group a little bit. And one guy one day brought in an article from New Age magazine, which was an interview with Robert Bly, talking about the Iron John story and the effects of the loss of initiation, of male initiation in society. And we were fascinated by the article and very energized. And shortly thereafter, Robert was giving the reading that Tim was talking about in Minneapolis. And so our men's group went. And at that reading, Robert kind of said, well, you know, I've done a couple of these events for men in California, and I think one in Pennsylvania or something like that. It's about time we did one here in Minnesota. So if anyone's interested, just put your name down on a sheet of paper here. And he passed a sheet of paper around, and we all signed up. And one of the guys in my men's group, you know, grabbed the paper and said, I will organize this conference. So that's kind of how that fell out. And that was the 1984 conference.
Mm. That's interesting, like, to hear that there was already men's groups happening, like small local men's groups. I was born in 74, so I kind of missed all of that, or I was very young when it was going on, and I'd hear echoes of it from, you know, Iron John coming out and King Warrior Magician Lover. But I always just kind of assumed that men's groups kind of started following the men's conferences and the whole men's movement.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of them did. Like I said, ours was just kind of a reaction to, well, all our partners are having breakfast. Why don't we, you know, burn some French toast together, you know? So, but a number of the guys there were, you know, fairly connected with, you know, with spiritual matters and things like that. So it's not a surprise that we kind of found that, or it found, you know, that article found us. Mm. We also read a poem in that group called Men Don't Dance in America. And then at the conference, I met the author of that poem, who's sitting right here on the other screen right now, too. So.
Oh, wow. A few years ago, I was given a box full of old yoga journal magazines. I've been a yoga teacher for many years. And in this box of musty old yoga journal magazines from the 80s was an issue that had Robert Bly on the cover, like his big face on the cover of Yoga Journal magazine, which now just seems crazy, like that there would be that kind of crossover. But I guess in the 80s, the New Age was, there was a lot of cross-pollination and mixing and matching. And so I guess maybe at that time it wouldn't be so, I don't know what the right word is, but so out of the blue to see him on a yoga magazine.
Yeah. And to my knowledge, I don't ever recall Robert doing yoga, but, but as you're saying, there was a lot of kind of cross-pollination and, exchange of ideas and thoughts. So, you know, it's not unusual. The first conference we did have a yoga teacher, Richard Close, who was an artist, a sculptor, and a yoga teacher.
And Robert was bending over and doing a number of things. And it was at that, at the first time I ever did yoga, Robert was sitting, was right next to me. And as we're bending over and doing these things, he leaned over and growled and bit me in the shoulder. that's how he dealt with this discomfort, I believe. But it was very playful and wonderful to have that happen. You know, I'm not sure if he had recognized me from the poetry seminar earlier the year before or not, but we've had a delightful few days there with Robert.
Mm. Yeah, could you guys talk a little bit about that first conference? Like, where did it take place? How many men were involved? Who were the speakers? And kind of give us a sense of the whole feeling of the thing.
Yeah, well, it was a kind of a seminal conference, I think. I'm thinking there were, what, maybe 50 or 60 men, Tim?
63, I counted again.
Okay, 63 men there. It was at a YMCA camp called Camp Weejawagon, which is north of Ely, Minnesota, which is far up as on a lake. It's on a lake on the Boundary Waters, so there's not very many cabins other than Y camps and things on that lake. So you don't see lights across the lake very much there, and so it gets very dark at night, and northern lights and that kind of thing are available. The other teachers were Michael Mead was there, and they were telling, Michael was kind of carrying the stories, he and Robert. The story they were sharing was, the main story was Iron John, of course. And then Terry Dobson, who was an Aikido master and actually brought Aikido to North America, was there. And then, as I mentioned, Richard Close, who was who taught yoga and was also a sculptor. So that was kind of the staff. And you know, sadly, Robert's stepson was killed during that conference. And so he got word, I think, the conference started on a Tuesday Monday or Tuesday, and like the third day of the conference, Robert suddenly had to leave, and you know, was in terrible grief, and that that seeing him grieve like that, you know, very much sort of grounded and kind of galvanized that group of men, I think, at that conference.
It plunged us into a deep hole of grief. Because many of us had gone there looking for the father. And then this this artistic father figure, Robert Bly, with his white hair and his vibrancy, is suddenly comes back into the room to tell us what happened, and he's weeping and he's falling down. He's just in torment with grief, and we all gathered around him, and I had never experienced that type of grieving among men. And when Robert then left, then we had to decide if we're going to cut the week short or continue. The leaders, Michael Mead, Terry, and Richard, and the organizers all decided that we would continue. So we continued for another 4 days without Robert. And something cracked. I know it cracked in me, cracked away so many of my expectations. As I said, I'd been had a few poems published, and I had come into this conference with a fairly large ego. The title of that conference is Why Do Men Dance? And of course, I had this poem published the previous year called Men Don't Dance in America. So I had assumed it was, you know, centered on my poem, which of course it wasn't, but that was my assumption. So my ego was split wide open. And at a very deep emotional and spiritual level. And we worked through that as a group of men in an incredible way, ritualistically, conversationally, musically. We had a carnival where we were dancing and letting the grief flow through our bodies. It was a very expressive week. Now, to give you another another picture here, when I arrived back in St. Paul after that week, I stopped to see my father and my younger brothers, who were at that time, they were still living at home. And my youngest brother walked out of the house and I grabbed him and gave him a huge hug, and his eyes got extremely large and white because men didn't hug one another in those days. So he didn't know what to expect. And he said that I looked like I was on fire, and I didn't feel that, but that's what he said it looked like. Now all my brothers hug one another, you know, 38 years later, you know, it's not strange. And it's expected and appreciated. Just one change in 38 years for many men.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that story about Robert. I wasn't aware of that. Just kind of getting a sense of what that must have been like to be in the midst of that. I mean, grief has been such a predominant theme in Robert's work and the men's movement over the years. Why do you think grief is so important as a way into the men's work?
Well, I think we live in a kind of an assentive culture, right? We're trying to we're in many cases trying to escape pain or discomfort, and you know, religiously, the dominant religions are, you know, about ascent and getting to heaven. You know, nobody wants to go into the underworld. But of course, that's a key component of real initiation, is to drop down. And so, you know, I think grief work and allowing grief to take you down, and not stuffing it or ignoring it or pretending it isn't there, and, you know, and trying to stay ascentive, is really key. And that was a key portion of men's work, because men's work really is about, you know, even if we don't do it, actually, you know, do initiations, it's about moving toward initiation. You know, it was the lack of initiation that, you know, that Robert was writing about in Iron John. And so all of the stories, you know, have some form of going down in them. And, you know, and, you know, you have to, you know, when you're going down, it often entails grief and, you know, a kind of a breaking through of that. Because everyone has had some kind of trauma, and just to kind of cover it up with a new layer of paint is, you know, not helpful. So,
what I've found is, and that week exemplified it, is the grief. It cut through my expectations. It cut through my cerebral ego and allowed my emotions to go deep enough. And at the same time, to be exposed to other men, to be exposed to the natural world. I wasn't carrying a lot of shame about that grief. And over the years, what I've found is that the depth of grief that I don't deliberately go after grief, but after I have suffered grief and moved back out through the suffering, there's more access for the joy of life to come through. Because the more we paint over grief, you know, the more we deprive joy of coming through. And to be fully human, I think we have to have both of those at different times when it's appropriate, because both joy and grief will come when we least expect it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as you guys were talking about it, it came to mind that you know, maybe it's grief that initiates us into a fuller expression of what it means to be a man, or into a fuller emotional life. I think for a lot of us, it's easy to connect with anger. It's such a kind of warrior energy, and it's very defensive. But it seems to me that grief is what cracks us open.
Yeah. Anger is a shield, and grief is what so many of our veteran friends have to deal with. They have to go through the grieving process after the PTSD, or to grieve through the PTSD. And sometimes it's repetitive, repetitive, repetitive. But I know that the men that have processed the grief in that way, even after a simple ritual, their faces are on fire. Their faces are lit up. And that light may fade again. But there'll be time for another ritual. And I think that's what we have to pay attention to, those patterns and those cycles. And if we ignore it and just stuff it, you know, we become psychically and spiritually constipated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I hear a lot of people, there's a famous Canadian teacher named Stephen Jenkinson, who I've had on the podcast four times. He's been a really good teacher of mine. A documentary was done about him years ago that introduced him to a wider public called Grief Walker. And he wrote a book called Die Wise. And I think really spawned a whole new resurgence of people interested in death, dying, and grief work. So I hear people talk about needing to go into grief or to process grief, but often I don't think they have a clear idea of how to do quote unquote grief work. I'm wondering what you guys have learned over the years of doing the men's work in the conferences, if you could offer some, not a prescriptive how-to or anything like that, but some ideas of how grief work happens or how to process grief.
Well, I think it's, you know, when you actually make the grief conscious, when you actually, in essence, go down as the stories would have it. So, you know, if you're, you know, the dark man's sooty brother or the devil's sooty brother, you know, he goes under the earth for 7 years and tends the fires and cooks things off. But, you know, you could look at that as a place where you're doing a lot of kind of ashy work, and you know, that deep level of things, which includes grief and processing and cooking that kind of trauma, actually provides, you know, in the stories, it's down under the earth that where the gold, where the treasure resides, right? Or the power or the magic and those kinds of things. And, you know, I think that's true. When you look at artists, you know, like I was one time doing short little biographies of a number of poets, and it was incredible. Virtually all of them had a period where, you know, someone had given them a little shitty cabin they didn't care about out in the back 40. And they had this time where they were, you know, living like a hermit and, you know, barely going to town. But they were, you know, they were working on their craft in that time. And that's what, you know, in essence, helped them find their poetic voice and their poetic sense. You know, the poetry came to them through that, you know, difficult, you know, low status, ashy work. And I think that, you know, that can be true of any art or of any, you know, any, a genius, if you will, that's what's required, that hard, ashy work. And that work also, I think, grounds a person. You'll often see people who are, you know, brilliant and attentive and you know, at a young age and achieve success, and then, you know, there's a crash, or they, you know, they sell out or burn out or those kinds of things. But it's doing that hard, ashy work that is, I think, key to in increasing our ambit of our capabilities, and also rooting us in that, so we don't lose our way.
That's right. Even Robert Bly went through that period after graduating from Harvard, when he was living in a simple little basement apartment, I believe it's a basement apartment in New York, and he made money by painting while he was going back and forth to the libraries, while he was studying Pablo Neruda and other poets, and struggling as a poet for years in that way. He did his grief work coming out of the plains, you know, and being out in the East Coast, coming off the plains. When I was in graduate school, one of the professors told me a story about when Robert first went to Harvard. He was a bit embarrassed, I think, to be out on the West Coast with, or on the East Coast, and in Harvard, people would ask, "Well, where's your father's money from?" Well, Robert was from a small farmer in Madison, Minnesota, and he would say, "Well, my father's in land and cattle." You know, and there's a few documentaries about Robert's early days as a poet, and even long before the men's work and before he was a noted poet, you know, he was working on the farm, shoveling manure, you know, working in his chicken coop that he had turned into a study. So Robert did his work as a young man, and I think that's something that those of us who are older have to remind the younger men that you still have to go through this work. You know, if you want to have not a successful soul, but if you want to have a full soul and soulful life, you have to go through these stretches.
Hey, Tim, you got an air raid siren going off behind you?
It's the first Monday of the month. It happens, just a practice drill. It happens. It's right down the street. I'm sorry.
It brings me back to my childhood. We had a big air raid siren in our suburban neighborhood. And in the 80s, they would do those tests like every month. Yeah. But that was like during the Cold War, and, you know, these movies about nuclear disaster coming out on TV, and we were terrified.
Well, for us, it's tornado and serious storms like that that they prepare us for.
Interesting. So we're like invoking Robert's great spirit come blowing through.
Yeah.
He's going to come and mess things up and turn things over for us.
Even if it's only a test.
The big horn.
Foghorn, Leghorn.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when I'm listening to you guys talk about grief work, you're not being very specific, but kind of the themes I'm hearing are maybe we could say allowing yourself to have a dark period, allowing yourself to go down. There sounds like there's humility involved.
Humility comes from the word, you know, is the root word of humus, you know, it's the soil, earth, you know, so it is going down into that. But, you know, the other thing I would say that the early conferences and, you know, indeed the later ones as well, the work with men's conferences gave us was the idea that we didn't have to necessarily take that grief to a woman or to a partner. We right. could look to other men to help us contain that grief. And when things like that happen, you know, you can get your brothers together and go light a little fire in the woods and do what needs to be done, you know, and we still do that. And I think that's a real important role for many of the, you know, kind of small men's groups that came out of the men's conferences in the early days and hopefully still do. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's not just the grief over, maybe a loss that we've experienced in our life, but isn't there also something to grieving like experiences that we've lacked in our life, like an initiation or having the blessing of the Father, that kind of thing, and bringing sure. that to the forefront of men's consciousness to recognize what they're missing in a way and then honestly grieving that?
Yeah,
absolutely.
Like both you guys started out by saying, I think that you're looking for your father in seeking and going to the men's conference. Yeah.
That wasn't my intention to put it that way. There were many men in that conference. I had a long lasting and intense relationship with my father. And I know Walton also had, and I would say for the most part, my relationship was healthy with my father. But I know many men who have come to the conferences, they're always looking for the Father.
Yeah, and I think there's a different, you know, there's fathering and there's different fathering. You know, there's your biological, your family father. And as Tim said, I had a pretty good relationship with my father, but you know, there's also kind of a father of the soul, if you will, or, you know, and in initiations, that would be your godfather, right? Or your the initiator, right? And so, and we certainly, you know, different people kind of take that role a little bit in society, but it's very unconscious in modern culture. So I think the idea was to, you know, connect with some older men and have that kind of spiritual and soul connection to deepen your soul. And sometimes, you know, as we were talking about the other day with you, Brian, it isn't a formal thing where someone's sitting down and, you know, passing, you know, wisdom to you necessarily. I mean, they are, but they aren't. I remember, you know, an example is the first conference. Of course, Robert left and, you know, Michael Mead stepped in and as a relatively young man, looking back on it now, I think Michael was probably in his 40s when that conference took place. You know, he did a remarkable job holding that container, you know, and building that connection. But also for me, I hung out a lot at that conference with Terry Dobson, the Aikido master. And Terry was just this, amazing presence and giant, big character, you know. And there was a lot of, it wasn't anything Terry taught me. I don't have any real Aikido skills. I mean, there were things he taught me, but a lot of it was just kind of a shoulder to shoulder intimacy with Terry. There was this bodily connection of here's an older man who's enormously powerful, and I'm standing at his shoulder, and something is being transferred.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's really an important element that is hard to describe. It, you know, it's not necessarily valued in the society, but just having an older man, a powerful man at your shoulder is, I think, really important for men as their souls are developing.
I'd like to follow up on that because what struck me with Terry, I remember when he brought the crosscut saw out and he teamed us up, two men on a crosscut saw. And I, you know, I had grown up. My father had woodlands. I had been cutting wood my entire life. But Terry had us on this crosscut saw, and we had to learn how to let go. Pull, let go, pull, let go, working in tandem with another man. And suddenly, the metaphors sunk into my head and into my soul. I had totally ignored that. I didn't pay attention to that, even though I grew up with saws. I have crosscut saws in my garage right now as a reminder of that. That's how you have to work with another man.
Yeah, like the meaning comes through the embodied experience rather than through the head with a bunch of ideas and concepts. I really believe that too. I was on a call with one of my mentors, Thomas Moore, this morning, and he paraphrased the Buddha's teaching that healing happens through presence. And I was reminded of that when you're talking, Walton, about being next to the Aikido master. And I can imagine being in his presence and getting a sense of a man who's really embodied, who's powerful, but probably quite graceful as well. And I was thinking too, Walton, like what you're talking about, like when we're talking about looking for the father, there's many types of fathering, I think you said. And I think that's a really important point, that different men can fulfill different aspects of the father, like the archetypal father for us, and not to kind of put that all on our actual father. And like in my instance, it was finding a kind of a spiritual father who could initiate me into the kind of esoteric spirituality and things that I was interested in that my father, my actual father, had no relationship to. Right. And so once I met that spiritual father and he gave me his blessing by his presence and attention and encouragement, I was able to release a lot of resentment toward my own father for not being able to see me in that way or relate to me in that way. Yeah. And so it was that kind of healing that happened through the another kind of fathering, or somebody who could fulfill a different aspect of the father.
Yeah, and I think that's key. I mean, even regardless of what your relationship with your, you know, family father is, you know, there are things that are precluded from him giving that to you. It has to come from somewhere else.
And I would say the same thing about sons. There is no way that I can give my son the things that he needs to be full. He was fortunate that I had friends like Walton and some of the others around occasionally. They could see the things in my son that I couldn't see, simply because I was father.
So having a band of uncles around could be really helpful for a young boy growing up.
Very important,
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Yeah, I think that's something that's never really talked about, is the role of the uncle. You know, we hear a lot about father complexes and, you know, the kind of spiritual father, the guru type thing. But yeah, there's a really important role of the kind of men on the periphery of the nuclear family, the uncles and friends of the actual father.
Traditionally, in many cultures that practice initiation, it's the maternal uncle that kind of runs the initiation for the young man, or supports him through that or puts him through that. And so it's, you know, it's a connection to the maternal line and things like that as well. But yeah, I think, yeah, that kind of uncle, whether it's through a family or just through your father's friends kind of thing, or your mother's male friends, but someone that that kind of steps into that role. And I think it helps having a lot of, you know, kind of crazy uncles too, you know, for young men to meet a lot of characters, you know, like, you know, James Hillman, one of the things he talked about was, you know, it was important to introduce your children to a lot of characters in that way. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah. So they can see that there's not just one way to be a man or a woman, you know, looking at the father or the mother, but that masculinity can take all these different expressions.
And
yeah, it's my aspiration to be the crazy uncle, by the way. I don't have kids of my own, but if I'm going to be anything, it's going to be the crazy uncle who shows my nephews or other kids that, you can also do that.
Yeah,
I think that's right. And, you know, it's about the, you know, when the soul is really connected with, you know, it tends to, you know, when you become who you really are meant to be, you tend to take on some eccentricities and things get a little, get a little crazy and a little strange because, you know, you're not supposed to be a cog in a machine, right?
Yeah.
As I've gotten older, I've become that crazy, crazy uncle. I don't consider myself crazy, but my nephews, that's kind of the way they talk to me. I'm the alternative. In many ways.
Yeah, but like the uncle who, when they come over to your house, they can like kind of start sifting through the bookshelves and finding all these weird, strange books or these, like, you know, you've got some of the interesting objects behind you in your office. Yep. There. That's so important. Like, I remember going to my weird uncle who came into the family by marriage, and he was Italian, so he was like extra weird. My uncle Ezio. But I remember going over to his house, and as a really young kid, he could see my eccentricity in me, and he turned me on to like people like Frank Zappa and Captain Beefheart and yep. Peter Gabriel, like all this kind of weirdo music that my parents just weren't into. And so I loved going over to his place because he'd have all these like crazy rock posters up and like weird books and magazines and stuff I would never be exposed to at home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if you are crazy, I think it's important that the child be exposed to the non-crazies. They have to know how to deal with them too, because they'll see the craziness in the so-called normals.
Yeah, right. You know, as someone else who's been really important to me over the years is Martin Prechtel. And I know Robert kind of discovered him, right, and brought him in to the different conferences. Can you talk a little bit about like what it was like when Martin arrived on the scene?
Yeah, that was I think a huge shift in yes. the life of those conferences. Martin was is the real deal. He's been through, indigenous initiations, you know, him and Maladoma Somme came a little before Martin. Talk about crazy uncles. I mean, Martin came in and I think he had like big knives with him all the time. And this incredible, you know, hair with a top knot and weird, you know, vests and beadwork and jewelry just amazing stories. And then also Martin, along, I think, with Maladoma, really opened the conference to taking ritual to a next level as part of the conference. So there was a lot, you know, the early conferences, there was a lot of kind of lecture and discussion and stories and things like that, and a lot of talking and sharing and processing and whatnot. When Martin came in, the emphasis shifted to moving all of that, you know, out into the field and, you know, literally into a field and you know, dealing with ritual techniques and elements. So, and that's something, you know, we've carried on, and it's a hugely important piece to in a way bring the work you're doing out of the merely personal and bring it back to feed spirits and to connect with the land that you're on. And in essence, many of the stories, you know, the rituals often come out of the stories in some way, or recapitulate the story. And so in a way, the rituals are sort of dancing the story back into the land, because of course the stories sort of come out of a land, but many of these stories come from different places. And so, you know, we're actually introducing them to this continent, this place, through those rituals.
Yeah, I think so. So what I'm imagining is you could be working through a story, and maybe an image or a scene from the story kind of inspires you to go create a ritual in a way. Is that how it would work?
Yeah, or it might inspire some aspect of a shrine, or you know, often the rituals are kind of involve kind of a journey and then out into some area where there's a shrine, or something is processed, or something is witnessed, or an offering is made, often that kind of thing. And then there's a return to the community fire. I mean, that's the basic pattern of a lot of rituals. You know, you kind of go out, you go through something, and then, you know, when it's time, you come back in and bring that energy back to the community. Yeah, I kind of lost my train of thought, but yes, that's kind of the idea. And often the kind of stations or shrines or things like that will have some element that in some way reflects or recalls or reconstitutes the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we were talking about Martin and what it was like when he arrived on the scene, and you brought up Maladoma. So when those guys entered the conferences, I can imagine that they brought, maybe for the first time, a non-European sensibility and non-European stories and rituals into it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Very, very much so. I mean, you know, there, I think people had, you know, there had been some stories that were non-European shared before them, and some people had done some medicine work with non-Europeans in various places. But yeah, Martin and Maladoma Somme were, I think, huge accelerators and influencers in that kind of ritual work, and connecting to,
yeah,
you know, to actual medicine societies that, you know, that they'd been part of, you know.
Yeah, like connecting to living traditions. And
yeah.
And what Martin said, and Maladoma too, in his own way, was that, you know, what they'd been tasked with was that the elders had seen that way of life was essentially dying. The villages were oppressed and messed up and, you know, things like that. And their mission, if you will, was to kind of replant the medicine, you know, in the heart of the enemy. Yeah.
Right. Mm. Yeah. And one of the things that I wanted to reiterate was both Martin and Maladoma kept reinforcing the importance of the larger community. Yeah, we didn't go through these rituals just for personal enlightenment. We had to feed the community. We had to feed the environment around us. And so we were always encouraged. Martin always encouraged us to do rituals together, to gather together. It was important. And he basically said that at some day, I'm not going to be around to help you guys. You guys have to learn this yourself. And it's difficult because I think we've tried to keep learning this. Martin's back in the mountains again. We can't just give him a phone call and say, well, what should we do? So we have to tap into our ancestral depths, into the memory depths that Martine and Melodoma introduced us, and do the best we can. And I think that's what we've been trying to do with the Minnesota Men's Conference. And we have Miguel Rivera still with us. He was at that very first men's conference that Martine was at. They came in and I thought they had known each other a long time, but they had only recently met at that first men's conference. So we, these threads keep us together. You know, Miguel now, that's 30 years ago that Miguel showed up. And a number of us have been doing this for 40 years. And Walton's son, my son, a couple other young fellas have all participated over the years. It takes a long time for this interactivity to come out like and blossom in the natural environment. I remember Robert Bly when he first started. He says, don't expect a whole lot of this to happen overnight. This might take 150, 200 years for it to fully come to fruition. Mm. And after 40 years, I see that.
Yeah. I think it's important to note too, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Martine and Melodoma would both say that it was important for us kind of the European diaspora, you know, these displaced Europeans who find themselves a couple generations later on this quote unquote new land, that it's important for us not to just appropriate the Guatemalan right. or African right. rituals and songs, yep. but to be inspired by the land that we find ourselves on and the stories from our own ancestry and yep. somehow within that form a new kind of ritual. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's absolutely right, Brian. I think they would both agree and had said much the same thing. You know, there's a story. Martine brought some corn. It was there's kind of a sacred patch of corn that's used in ritual and that kind of thing in the village. And he brought some of that corn and he passed it out to people in various places. And, you know, not really knowing if it would really germinate, you know, but a number of the guys actually did get a crop to grow of the corn. But when they brought it back, it looked completely different than the corn that had been planted, you know, and it was, you know, I mean, the realization was like, okay, well, they're planting it, but they're planting it in different soil. It's a different environment. There's different medicine. There's different spirits. And yeah, it's going to look different here than it did down there. So. Hmm.
Tim, were you going to say something?
Yeah. Gary Snyder, the poet, in Mother Earth News back in the early 80s, there was an article about Gary Snyder. And he mentioned that he had been talking to, I believe, a Blackfeet elder and asked him what he thought about the white race. And the elder told him, he said, I'm not too worried, he said, because you haven't been on the land long enough yet. When you can start speaking for the land, things are going to change because you'll be feeling and connected with the land, and the land is going to change you and it's going to change itself. And that gave me an incredible amount of hope when I read that, you know, because, you know, we're acting at a human level, not at the level of the earth, at this pace of the earth, you know. And especially now that we have all of this technology that we are instantaneously connecting around the globe, you know, we have to remind ourselves that the earth is operating at a different pace than we are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and culture moves more slowly too. Like, it's like the pace of the soul, right? It's just, it's yep. moving at a much slower pace than the mind, you know, the kind of hermetic mind that's jumping around from thing to thing to thing. I think that's a really good point. Like, if we think about it, like those first conferences, you know, 1984, like 30 years ago or whatever, close to it, right? 30 years ago isn't really a long time for those seeds to start germinating. Like, no. You know, I'm like the next generation on.
Yep.
It's only one generation for this stuff to start to grow and find its form. So it's still very quite young when you think about it that way.
Yeah. You know, the other thing I wanted to mention is that, you know, I think we've used the word men's movement, and certainly that was bandied about at the time, and it got placed in juxtaposition to, you know, to feminism, right? You know, like it was supposedly a reaction. Of course, that caused a lot of friction and things like that. I don't necessarily think there was ever a movement. There have been movements that's kind of sprung out of this in different ways, or attempts to, some people have attempted to create a movement out of it, but I don't think it was ever at its core a movement in the sense of a political movement. It was more of a looking at of a stopping and a going down and looking at ways to make some alchemical or soul changes. But it, you know, it wasn't analogous in a way to the women's movement, which was about, you know, social and political and economic freedom for women and justice for them. You know, that wasn't what was going on with us.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. I wanted to ask you about that, because sometimes what I've seen, especially in older articles about Bly and the quote unquote men's movement, is it somehow like people's impression of it was something more like what the men's rights movement that has cropped up, what it is.
Yeah.
And it wasn't really about that at all. It was like maybe men's right to grieve or to feel, but it was a much different type of thing. It wasn't looking for more prominence in the society or anything like that. So I find that strange how it could be equated. Like, I had someone on the podcast recently who's an older guy, and he wrote a book critiquing Robert Bly. And his whole take on it was that it was anti-feminist. And I completely disagree. I think that's a naive take, because if you listen to the lectures from that time or since, if you read Robert Bly's work, you can see that that's not what it was about at all.
No.
Right. And much of it was about connecting with the interior feminine, with the psychic feminine, you know.
Right.
Robert, like, the animating force, you know.
Yeah, it was about honoring the feminine. Like, he also had a conference called the Great Mother Conference, right?
Yeah, which the men's conference has actually sprung out of the Great Mother Conference.
Yes.
They preceded them. And he was noticing there seemed to be, you know, kind of an energy and a depth lacking in the men. You know, they were, you know, nice new age guys, but there was some kind of depth that was not there. And I think that's what actually started his questioning that led to Iron John and all of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Robert, while he was writing Iron John, he was running a lot of the material past his daughters, you know, to see how it felt to his daughters, which is that was wonderful in that way, because Robert had two daughters and a stepdaughter, and there's no way in the world, and especially today, if you were to see Robert's daughters and stepdaughters, they're all brilliant minds and wonderful, well-rounded people. And Robert included them. And you'll find it occasionally here and there in Iron John where he mentions his daughters, but he actually came to our men's council and would review chapters with us as he was writing Iron John. Hmm. And so we were able to be involved in that. And that was the one of the great things about Robert. He wasn't he was willing to share his insecurities about what he was doing.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to...
I want to interject something there too.
For sure.
The two teachers I hear Robert acknowledge the most are Marie-Louise von Franz, who taught him how to work with stories, particularly fairy stories, and Marion Woodman, who he did a number of presentations with, and who I think really inspired him to bring the body into the work that he was doing. I think that was really inspired by Marion. So I'm glad to address this because, like I said, it came up in a recent podcast conversation that I had, and it's something I hear sometimes. It sounds like a bit like a knee-jerk reaction to the idea of a men's movement is that it's anti-feminist. And just wanted to put that to rest.
Yeah. The other thing I was going to say is that I think in the kind of popular media, the work got mocked as a bunch of men going into the woods and, you know, painting themselves and pounding drums and we were in the woods and we were pounding drums and things like that. But they grabbed on to the image of the wild man, you know, the Iron John, the hairy man thing, and then mocked it as, you know, stockbrokers, you know, putting their tie around their head and painting their faces and banging on a drum. And, you know, and that was just, you know, an kind of an easy way for them to dismiss or process it in however they needed to process it, you know. But it reminds me of the Goethe statement, you know, tell a wise man or else keep silent, because the masked man will mock it right away. And that is what happened. The masked man did mock the work, but at its core the work was very deep and beautiful. And, you know, was there silliness and mistakes and things that happened along the way? Sure. But it wasn't what was portrayed in the mass media.
Yeah. Yeah. Just another instance of men being ridiculed in mass media. Like that was the time of also like, what was that TV show? It was Ed Bundy, the shoe salesman. Married with Children.
Oh yeah.
And then The Simpsons came out with Homer, and it was just these idiotic men portrayed on the screen. And I think it was all part of it too, is that mocking. I remember seeing scenes like that in mainstream movies, like you said, the tie around the head and just looking ridiculous and infantile. Yeah. Well, you know, I think it's important, like you guys have been doing this work a long time, and maybe you could talk a little bit about what the real world consequences of the men's work and the men's conference have been in your lives and in the lives of some of the men who have gone through it with you.
Yeah, well, I mean, the initial consequence was it actually gave me, the very first conference gave me the grounding to feel like I could be capable of being a father. And, my daughter was born just before the second conference. So, that was a huge shift because, I did not feel that kind of groundedness before and connection to a kind of an ancestral power and capability in that way. That was the immediate effect of the first conference. Over the years, Tim and I the men that I've been at the conference with have gone through a lot of life together, and have leaned on each other, sometimes leaned really hard on each other, to get through it. And without the conferences, I would be kind of stuck with, the nuclear family to lean on and not a community, a larger community. So that's been enormous for me.
Absolutely. I come from a large extended family. And like you, Brian, my father is a working class meat cutter. And I couldn't, I couldn't go to them about my interests. And they supported me in a very physical way. And I learned a lot of physical things from them. But the artistic part of me, it had nowhere to be. And I was ascending. You know, I wanted to be the great American novelist. I wanted to follow, you know, the path of the great poets. Unfortunately, I didn't have, I shouldn't say that. Unfortunately, it was the wrong direction. You know, I was ascending. And Robert Bly, when I met him, it altered the path. For me, it altered my direction. I was no longer going to be the great writer in the way I had wanted to be. I was in the middle of journalism school. And when I had poetry published for the first time, suddenly I could see that, oh, my life can be totally different and extremely fulfilling without having those successes that the culture was telling me I had to have. And I've had great friendships. You know, Robert Bly helped publish my first book. I would have never had that without Robert, possibly. And many of the friendships have continued to develop and expand in ways that I could have never imagined. I ended up teaching at a youth correctional facility for 8 years. That would never have even entered my mind had I not been involved in this work earlier. I have no idea what the effects are of that, but I know it helped me a lot. I learned a lot working with those boys at the correctional facility. So my life would have been a lot different. And as I mentioned before, I can hug my brothers now without any shame. And in 1980, that would have never happened. The condescension and the mocking that came if you hug someone. And I'll give you a quick example. It was right after the first men's conference in 1984. One of the men who was there owned a Harley Davidson dealership right near where I worked. And I walked into his shop. He was behind the counter, and he came out, and we gave each other this enormous bear hug on the floor of the Harley Davidson shop. And you can imagine all the bikers that were in there giving us the evil eye and all of what they might have thought was going on. Now, you can't go into a biker shop without the bikers giving one another a hug. So things have changed in many different ways at many different levels.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think also just culturally, I mean, I think you see men much more engaged with their children than they were before. Yes. Robert Bly started. That was, you know, that's a huge and I think kind of little observed effect, but you know, it's not uncommon to see you know, dads out in the park with their kids, or, you know, pushing, you know, hauling a little baby around, or any of those things. There's much more engagement with our children, you know, which was a big part of what Robert was writing about the loss, yep, of that with the Industrial Revolution and men going out into the world and becoming kind of the 50s fathers that the sons didn't know, or the daughters didn't know either.
In 1984, there was no such thing as a diaper changing table in a men's room at the gas station. You know, they're all over.
Yes, and the most read poet in America was Rod McEwen, who wrote, you know, The Clouds from Both Sides Now, and now the most read poet in America is Rumi. So
I was going to say, yeah, it's got to be Rumi.
And Robert was the first one to translate Rumi.
Yeah, here. Holman Barks, but Robert very much made that part of the culture.
Mm. That's great. Well, you guys have done such an incredible service stewarding this work since, you know, Robert had to step back from it. And I'm curious, like, you know, when you see new guys coming up, what do you think the future of men's work looks like? Do you see anything shifting and changing, or do you see anything on the horizon?
You know, it's a good question. It's really hard to say, and it may be that that men's work is not a is less of a mass movement and more of a lot of men kind of going to ground, or a lot of men getting together, around a small fire and sitting close and things like that. Obviously, we're still producing conferences, and they have varying attendances and things like that. It may be that it's, a lot of men kind of to use an image from the stories, riding the slow, shaggy pony rather than the big war horse,
Yeah. There's a life force that's moving through all of us. It's coming out of the earth. It's moving through our bodies. Our bodies will desire certain things. And I think ritual is one of those things that our bodies desire, because our bodies cannot hold trauma for long stretches. Our bodies want to release trauma. Our bodies want to feel the joy that's moving through us. And the more that we're aware of this, the more hope that I have. Already all over, people are connecting, just as we are right now, through technology, over the airwaves. We're connecting. It's not quite enough, but it's a way to share information. And once we have that information, our bodies are going to want to process that information in ways that we hadn't thought about before. Yeah. And ritual is a way to do it.
Yeah. And the other thing I want to say is that I think the damage to the world around us, mm-hmm. To the climate, to the land, to the waters, to the air and things like that, the reaction may be, and I hope part of it is to do this kind of work, is to engage, re-engage and reacquaint ourselves, with the land, with the water, and to view those things as as the animated beings that they are, and to, work to reestablish the original instructions for human beings living on the planet. So, I think as things get worse, the need will get greater for people to be able to do that. So,
Yeah. Well, let me just speak to the legacy from where I sit. The groundwork that was laid by you guys and Robert and Michael and Martine and Maladoma all those years ago, I mean, the ripples are still rippling out. I had a guy contact me yesterday, early 30s, who's discovered the Minnesota Men's Conference videos on YouTube. It's led him to read Iron John and get into Michael Mead's work. It's out there still working, kind of awakening men to this other dimension of life that they may not get from their family or their culture, and inspiring them to broaden their horizons and to become a more soulful and multifaceted man. So it's still happening, and it may not be the kind of cultural movement that it was, you know, when it was new and, you know, had Robert Bly, like you said, this amazing personality at the forefront. But yeah, it's still having an effect, but maybe on a more grassroots level or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that that's very possible. I mean, I think the one danger is that, I mean, I think it's great that people access, you know, that information, that they go out and they read Iron John or read the Sibling Society or, you know, follow Michael's work or any of that is great. But, you know, they should also know that part of the work is not simply being a passive consumer of information. The real work involves, you know, kind of coming together, you know, with other men and you know, slogging through some of that stuff and having that shoulder to shoulder intimacy we were talking about.
Yeah, it's so important because, you know, we can stay in our magician minds and just collect all of the information and the goodies. But when we're together with men, that's when our wounds get triggered often, right? And so then it brings up what needs to come up to be worked through.
Yeah, and also to create a container, not just for yourself, but for other men or for, and even for younger men coming in, you know, so.
Yeah, you're going to, if you show up, you're going to trigger the right man in a very particular way that he needs to be triggered or inspired. If,
yeah.
You know, yeah. Tim, did you want to say something?
I was thinking about the heat that occurs. And in alchemy, there's a phrase that says, don't let your fire get hotter than that of freshly dropped horse shit. And that's where the processing takes place. You know, the processing in alchemy, the changes have to reach that level of heat. You don't want it to be, you know, a blast furnace. And so many ascendant people want to go into the, you know, fly away into the sun, you know, fly off into the farthest galaxy and experience that fire. But true transformation occurs at a lower level of heat.
Yeah, you got to get down in the shit.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, and cook slowly.
Yep, yeah. That's right.
Well, that's great, guys. Thanks so much for sharing your stories and some of your wisdom that you've acquired over the years. We really appreciate it. I know there's other guys out there who are going to really appreciate this as well. So this isn't over. I mean, the Minnesota Men's Conference is still happening, even through COVID. What's going on with it now? Are you guys going back to meeting in person?
We are. We have a fall conference that's being held near the Twin Cities at a Y camp, actually just across the border in Hudson, Wisconsin. October, the weekend of October 7th, 8th, and 9th, we're doing a 3-day in-person conference. So invite men to show up.
Yeah. If they need information, just go to our website, MinnesotaMensConference.com.
Great. Yeah. The guy I spoke to yesterday, he's in Wisconsin. So I know I'm going to be sending him the link. That's for sure.
Yes.
Again, he's a guy who's read all the books, listened to all the lectures, but he hasn't met in person with a group of men before, which is a real, its own unique thing.
It's like a football player who studies all of the plays and knows all of the plays, but you have to get on the field and actually play.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much, guys. And, you know, maybe I'll make it out there one of these days while you're still around.
That would be great. We'd love to see
you. Likewise, Brian.
Thank you for having us.
Yep.
Yeah. Maybe when it's a little warmer, though. I think Wisconsin in October, November would be pretty chilly. Yeah.
Well, there's heat.
All right. Yeah. There's enough horse shit to keep us warm.
There's enough horse shit to keep us.
Thanks, guys. You take good care.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brian. Take care.
Bye-bye.
The Medicine Path is produced by Brian James on unceded Coast Salish territory, Vancouver Island, Canada. For more information, visit brianjames.ca. Music by Olive Artizzoni, a.k.a. Greenhouse. Join the Medicine Path tribe and gain early access to episodes and the full podcast archives at patreon.com/medicinepath. May the road rise up to meet you. May the wind be always at your back. May the sun shine warm upon your face. May the rain fall soft upon your fields. Until the next time we meet on the Medicine Path.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.